Atlas. Day 4. 27 degrees 95 minutes north, 83 degrees 99 minutes west. Wind south-southeast, 10 to 15 knots, gusts to 20. Skies clear, seas running 3 to 4 feet. After 3 days of light air, we are finally making decent headway, running at 6 to 8 knots. I expect we will reach Florida's west coast by nightfall, just north of Tampa. Peter seems to be finally getting his sea legs. After 3 days vomiting over the side, he announced today that he was hungry. From Lish, not very much. She sleeps most of the time and has said virtually nothing. Everyone is worried about her. Day 6. 26 degrees 15 minutes north, 79 degrees 43 minutes west. Wind south-southeast 5 to 10 knots, shifting. Partly cloudy, seas running 1 to 2 feet. We have rounded the Florida Peninsula and turned north. From here we will leave the coast behind and make a straight shot for the outer banks of North Carolina. Heavy clouds all night, but no rain. Lish is still very weak. Amy finally talked her into eating, and Peter and I drew straws. He was the winner. Though I guess it depends on how you look at it. I was a little nervous about Sarah's instructions, and I'm no good with needles. So Amy took over. 1 pint. We'll see if it helps. Day 9. 31 degrees 87 minutes north, 75 degrees 25 minutes west. Winds south-southeast 15 to 20 knots, gusts to 30. Skies clear, seas running 5 to 7 feet. A horrible night. The storm hit just before sunset. Huge seas, high winds, driving rain. Everyone was up all night working the bailers. Blown way off course, and the self-steerer is shot. We've taken on water, but the hull seems tight. Running reefed in heavy air. No jib. Day 12. 36 degrees 75 minutes north, 74 degrees 33 minutes west. Winds north-northeast, 5 to 10 knots. Patchy clouds. Seas running 2 to 3 feet. We have decided to head west for the coast. Everyone is exhausted and needs to rest. On the bright side, Lish seems to have turned a corner. Her back is the issue. She's still in a lot of pain and can barely bend at all. My turn with the needle. Lish seemed to have a little fun with that. "Oh, buck up, Circuit," she said. "A girl's got to eat. Maybe your blood will make me smarter." Day 13. 36 degrees 56 minutes north, 76 degrees 27 minutes west. Winds north-northeast, 3 to 5 knots. Seas running 1 to 2 feet. Lying at anchor at the mouth of the James River. Fantastic wreckage everywhere. Huge naval vessels, tankers, even a submarine. Lish's mood has improved. At sunset, she asked us to bring her up on deck. A beautiful, starlit night. Day 15. 38 degrees, 3 minutes north, 74 degrees, 50 minutes west. Winds light and variable. Seas 2 to 3 feet. Underway again with fair winds, running at 6 knots. Everyone feels it. We are getting closer. Day 17. 39 degrees, 63 minutes north, 75 degrees, 52 minutes west. Winds south-southeast, 5 to 10 knots. Seas, 3 to 5 feet. Tomorrow, we reach New York. 80. The four of them sat in the cockpit in the gathering dusk. They were lying at anchor. Off the port bow, a long sandy line. The southern edge of Staten Island, once populated by a dense humanity, now exposed, swept clean. A wilderness. "So, we're all in agreement?" Peter said, scanning the group. "Michael?" Seated by the tiller, he was fingering a pocket knife, opening and closing the blade. His face had been crisped by salt and wind. Through his beard, the color of sand, his teeth shone white. I told you before. If you say that's the plan, then that's the plan. Peter turned to Alicia. Last chance to weigh in here. Even if I said no, you wouldn't listen. I'm sorry, that's not good enough. She looked at him guardedly. He's not going to just surrender, you know. I'm sorry. I guess I was wrong after all. Not really the man's style. That's why I need you in the tunnel with Michael. I belong in the station with you. Peter looked at her pointedly. You can't kill him. You said so yourself. You can barely walk. I know you're angry and you don't want to hear this, but you need to put your feelings aside and leave that part to me and Amy. You'd only slow us down, and I need you to protect Michael. Fanning's virals won't attack you. You can give him cover. Peter could see that his words had stung. Alicia glanced away, then back, her eyes narrowed with warning. You realize that he knows we're coming. I seriously doubt any of this has escaped his attention. Waltzing into the station plays straight into his hands. That's the idea. And if this doesn't work, then we all die and Fanning wins. I'm willing to hear a better idea. You're the expert on the man. Tell me I'm wrong and I'll listen. That's not fair. I know it's not. A brief silence passed. Alicia sighed in surrender. Fine, I can't. You win. Peter looked toward Amy. After 2 weeks at sea, her hair had grown out somewhat, softening her features while also making them seem clearer somehow, sturdier and more defined. I think it all depends on what Fanning wants, she said. From you, you mean? Maybe he just intends to kill me. And if so, there's not a lot to stop him. But he's gone to a lot of trouble to get me here, if that's all he has in mind. What do you think he wants? The light was nearly gone. From the shore, the long shushing of waves. I don't know, she said. I agree with Lish, though. The man has something to prove. Beyond that, she trailed off, then continued. The important thing is to make sure he's in that station. Get him there and keep him there. We shouldn't wait for Michael. We need to be there when the water hits. That's our moment. So you agree with the plan? She nodded. Yes. I think it's our best chance. Let's look at that drawing. Alicia had sketched a simple map, streets and buildings, but also what lay beneath them and points of access. To this, she added verbal descriptions, how things looked and felt, certain landmarks, places where their passage would be obstructed by forest growth or collapsed structures, the sea's margins where it lapped over the southern tier of the island. Tell me about the streets around the station, Peter said. How much shade is there for the virals to move in? Alicia thought for a moment. Well, a lot. Midday you'd get more sun. But the buildings are all very tall. I'm talking 60, 70 stories. It's like nothing you've ever seen in your life, and it can get pretty dark at street level any time of day. She drew their attention to the drawing again. I'd say your best bet would be here, at the station's west exit. Why there? 2 blocks west, there's a construction site. The building's 52 stories tall, not huge by the standards of what's around it, but the top 30 stories are only framed in. There's good sun around the base, even late in the day. You can see it from the station. There's an external elevator and a crane up the side of the building. I used to spend a lot of time up there. On the crane, you mean? Alicia shrugged. Yeah, well, it was kind of a thing with me. She offered no more explanation. Peter decided not to press. He pointed to another spot on the map, a block east of the station. What's this? The Chrysler Building. It's the tallest thing around there, almost 80 stories. The top is made of this kind of shiny metal, like a crown. It's highly reflective. Depending on where the sun is, it can throw a lot of light. The day was over. The temperature had dropped, drawing dew from the air. As a silence settled, Peter realized they had come to the end of the conversation. In a little under 8 hours, they would raise the sails, the Nautilus would make the final leg to Manhattan, and whatever was bound to happen there would happen. It was unlikely that all of them would survive, or even that any of them would. "I'll take the watch," said Michael. Peter looked at him. "We seem well protected here. Is that necessary? The bottom's pretty sandy. The last thing we need is a dragging anchor right now." "I'll stay too," Lish said. Michael smiled. "Can't say I'd mind the company." Then, to Peter, "It's fine. I've done it a million times. Go sleep. You two are going to need it." Night spread her hands over the sea. All was still. Only the sounds of the ocean, deep and calm, and the lap of waves against the hull. Peter and Amy lay curled together on the cabin's only bunk, her head resting on his chest. The night was warm, but below decks the air felt cool, almost cold, chilled by the water encircling the bulkhead. "Tell me about the farmstead," Amy said. Peter needed a moment to gather his answer, lulled by the boat's motion and the feeling of closeness. He had, in fact, been skating on the edge of sleep. "I'm not sure how to describe it. They weren't like ordinary dreams. They were far more real than that. Like, every night I went someplace else. Another life.
Like a different world. Real, but not the same."
He nodded, then said, "I didn't always remember them, not in detail. It was mostly the feeling that lasted. But some things, the house, the river, ordinary days, the music you played, such beautiful songs. I could have listened to them forever. They seemed so full of life." He stopped, then said, "Was it the same for you?"
"I think so, yes."
"But you're not sure." She hesitated.
"It only happened the one time, when I was in the water. I was playing for you. The music came so easily, as if the songs had been inside me and I was finally letting them out."
"What happened then?" Peter asked.
"I don't remember. The next thing I knew, I woke up on the deck. And there you were."
"What do you think it means?" She paused before answering.
"I don't know. All I know is that for the first time in my life, I was truly happy."
For a while, they listened to the quiet creaking of the boat.
"I love you," Peter said. "I think I always have. And I love you."
She drew herself closer against him. Peter replied in kind. He took her left hand, slipped her fingers through his, pulled it to his chest, and held it there.
"Michael's right," she said. "We should sleep."
"All right." Soon, she felt his breathing slow. It eased into a deep, long rhythm, like waves upon the shore. Amy closed her eyes, although she knew it was no use. She would lie awake for hours. On the deck of the Nautilus, Michael was watching the stars. Because a person could never grow tired of them. All his many nights at sea, the stars had been his most loyal companions. He preferred them to the moon, which seemed to him too frank, always begging to be noticed. The stars maintained a certain cagey distance, permitting the mystery of their hidden selves to breathe. Michael knew what the stars were. Exploding balls of hydrogen and helium, as well as many of their names and the arrangements they made in the night sky. Useful information for a man alone at sea in a small boat. But he also understood that these things were in imposed ordering that the stars themselves possessed no knowledge of. Their vast display should have made him feel tiny and alone, but the effect was exactly the opposite.
It was in daylight that he felt his solitude most keenly. There were days when his soul ached with it, the feeling that he had moved so far away from the world of people that he could never go back. But then night would fall, revealing the sky's hidden treasure. The stars, after all, weren't gone during the day, merely obscured. And his loneliness would recede, supplanted by the sense that the universe, for all its inscrutable vastness, was not a hard, indifferent place in which some things were alive and others not, and all that happened was a kind of accident, governed by the cold hand of physical law, but a web of invisible threads in which everything was connected to everything else, including him. It was along these threads that both the questions and the answers to life pulsed like an alternating current. All the pains and regrets, but also happiness and even joy, and though the source of this current was unknown and always would be, a person could feel it if he gave himself a chance. And the time when Michael Fisher, Michael the Circuit, first engineer of light and power, boss of the trade and builder of the Bergensfjord, felt it most was when he was looking at the stars. He thought of many things. Days in the sanctuary, Elton's blind, rigid face and the hot, cramped quarters of the battery hut, the gassy stink of the refinery where he had left boyhood behind and found his course in life. He thought of Sarah, whom he loved, and Lore, whom he also loved, and Kate, and the last time he had seen her, her compact, youthful energy and easy affection for him on the night when he had told her the story of the whale. All so long ago, the past forever retreating to become the great internal accumulation of days. Probably his time on Earth was reaching its end. Maybe something came after, beyond one's physical existence as a person. On this subject, the heavens were obscure. Greer certainly thought so. Michael knew that his friend was dying. Greer had tried to conceal it, and nearly had. But Michael had figured it out. No one thing in particular had told him this. It was simply his sense of the man. Time was outstripping him, as, sooner or later, it did everyone. And of course, he thought about his ship, his Bergensfjord. She would be far away now, somewhere off the coast of Brazil, churning south beneath the self-same starry sky. "It's beautiful out here," Alicia said. She was sitting across from him, reclining lengthwise on the bench, a blanket covering her legs. Her head, like his, was tipped upward, her eyes glazed by starlight. "I remember the first time I saw them," she continued. "It was the night the colonel left me outside the wall. They absolutely terrified me." She pointed toward the southern horizon. "Why is that one so bright?" He followed her finger. "Well, that's not a star, actually. It's the planet Mars."
"How can you tell?"
"You'll see it most of the summer. If you look closely, you can see that it has a slight red tint. It's basically a big, rusty rock."
"And that one?"
"Directly overhead this time."
"Arcturus."
In the dark, her expression was hidden from his view, though he imagined her frowning with interest.
"How far away is it?"
"Not very, as these things go. About 37 light years. That's how long it takes the light to get here. When the light you're seeing left Arcturus, we were both a couple of kids. So when you look at the sky, what you're actually seeing is the past. But not just one past. Every star is different." She laughed lightly.
"That kind of messes with my head when you put it that way. I remember you telling me about this stuff when we were kids. Or trying to."
"I was pretty obnoxious. Probably I was just trying to impress you."
"Show me more," she said.
He did just that. Michael traced the sky. Polaris and the Big Dipper,
bright Antares and blue-tinted Vega and her neighbors, the small cluster known as Delphinus the Dolphin, the broad galactic band of the Milky Way, running horizon to horizon, north to south, bisecting the eastern sky like a cloud of light. He told her all he could think of, her interest never wavering, and when he was done, she said, "I'm cold." Alicia scooted forward from the transom. Michael crossed over and wedged himself behind her, his legs positioned on either side of her waist. He pulled the blanket up, wrapping the two of them, drawing her in for warmth. "We haven't talked about what happened on the ship," Alicia said. "We don't have to if you don't want." "I feel like I owe you an explanation."
"You don't."
"Why did you come in after me, Michael?"
"I didn't really give it a lot of thought. It was a heat-of-the-moment thing."
"That's not an answer."
He shrugged, then said,
"I guess you could say I don't much like it when people I care about try to kill themselves. I've been down that road before. I take it kind of personally."
His words stopped her flat.
"I'm sorry. I should have thought."
"And there's absolutely no reason you would have. Just don't do it again, okay? I'm not such a great swimmer."
A silence fell. It was not uncomfortable, but the opposite. The silence of shared history, of those who can speak without talking. The night was full of small sounds that, paradoxically, seemed to magnify the quiet. Each shifting touch of water against the hull, the pinging of the lines against the spars, the creak of the anchor line in its cleat.
"Why did you name her Nautilus?" Alicia asked.
The back of her head was resting against his chest.
"It was something from a book I read when I was a kid. It just seemed to fit."
"Well, it does. I think it's nice."
Then, quietly,
"What you said, in the cell."
"That I loved you."
He felt no embarrassment, only the calm of truth. "I just thought you should know. It seemed like a big waste otherwise. I've kind of had it with secrets."
"It's okay. You don't have to say anything about it."
"But I want to."
"Well, a thank you would be nice."
"It's not that simple."
"Actually, it's exactly that simple."
She fit the fingers of one hand into his, pressing their palms together.
"Thank you, Michael."
"And you are most welcome."
The air was damp, mist falling, beads clinging to every surface. At an indeterminate distance, waves were hissing on the sand.
"God, the two of us," she said. "We've been fighting our whole lives."
"That we have."
"I'm so tired of it."
She drew his arm tighter around her waist.
"I thought about you, you know, when I was in New York."
"Did you know?"
"I thought, what is Michael doing today? What is he doing to save the world?"
He laughed lightly.
"I'm honored."
"As you should be."
A pause. Then she spoke again.
"Do you ever think about them? Your parents?"
The question, though unexpected, did not seem strange.
"Once in a while. It was a long time ago, though."
"I don't really remember mine. They died when I was so young. Just little things, I guess. My mother had a silver hairbrush she liked. It was very old. I think it belonged to my grandmother. She used to visit me in the sanctuary and brush my hair with it."
Michael considered this.
"Now that sounds right to me. I think I recall something like that happening."
"You do?"
"She'd put you on a stool in the dormitory by the big window. I remember her humming. Not a song, exactly. More like just notes."
"Huh," Alicia said after a moment. "I didn't know anyone was paying attention."
They were quiet for a time.
Even before she said the words, Michael sensed their approach. He did not know what she was about to tell him, only that she was. Something happened to me in Iowa. A man raped me there, one of the guards. He got me pregnant. Michael waited. She was a girl. I don't know if it was what I am or something else, but she didn't survive. When Alicia fell silent, Michael said, "Tell me about her." "She was Rose. That's what I named her. She had such beautiful red hair. After I buried her, I stayed with her a while. 2 years. I thought it would help. Make things easier, somehow. But it never did." He felt suddenly closer to Alicia than he had to anyone in his life. Painful as this story was, telling him was a gift she had given him, the heart of who she was, the stone she carried, and how love had happened in her life. "I hope it's okay, I told you." "I'm very glad you did." Another silence, then, "You're not really worried about the anchor, are you?" "Not really, no." "That was nice, what you did for them." Alicia tipped her head upward. "It's such a beautiful night." "Yes, it is." "No, more than beautiful," she said, and squeezed his hand, nestling against him. "It's perfect." 81. So, at the last, a story. A child is born into this world. She is lost, alone, in due course both befriended and betrayed. She is the carrier of a special burden, a singular vocation that is only hers to bear. She wanders in a wasteland, a ruin of grief and tormented dreams. She has no past, only a long, blank future. She is like a convict with an unknown sentence, never visited in the cell of her interminable imprisonment. Any other soul would be broken by this fate, and yet the child abides. She dares to hope that she is not alone. That is her mission, the role for which she has been cast at heaven's cruel audition. She is hope's last vessel on the earth. Then, a miracle. A city appears to her, a bright walled city on a hill. Her prayers have been answered. Shining like a beacon, it has the aspect of a prophecy fulfilled. The key turns in the lock. The door swings open. Ensconced within its walls, she discovers a wondrous race of men and women who have, like her, endured. They become hers, after a fashion. In the eyes of this wordless child, the most prescient among them perceive an answer to their most persistent questions. As they have relieved her loneliness, so has she relieved theirs. A journey commences. The world's dark arrangement is revealed. The child grows. She leads her companion to a glorious victory. By her hand, seeds of hope are scattered over the land. Promise bubbles forth from every spring and stream. And yet she knows this flowering is an illusion, the merest respite. There can be no safety. Her triumphs have but scratched the crust. Below lies the dark core, that great iron ball beneath all things. Its compressed weight
is fantastic. It is older than time itself. It is a vestige of the blackness that predates all existence, when a formless universe existed in a state of chaotic uncreation, lacking awareness even of itself. She falters. She has doubts. She becomes indecisive, even fearful. Hers is the greatest of all errors. She has grown attached to life. She has dared, unwisely, to love. In her mind, a contest rages, that of one who questions fate. Is she merely a lunatic's puppet? Is she destiny's slave or its author? Must she turn away from all the things and people she has grown to love? And is this love a reflection of some grand design, a taste of an ordered and divine creation? Is it truth or a departure from the truth? Romantic love, fraternal love, the love of a parent for a child, and the love returned in kind. Are they a mirror to God's face, or the bitterest gall in a cosmos of sound and fury, signifying nothing? As for me, there was a time in my life when I put aside all doubt and supped at the flower of heaven. What sweet juice was there? What balm to all suffering, the soul's holy ache? That my Liz was dying did not countermand my joy. She had come to me like a messenger in the hours when all is laid bare to reveal my purpose on the earth. All my days, I had scrutinized the tiniest workings of life. I had gone about this task blandly, never fathoming my true motive. I gazed upon the smallest shapes and processes of nature, seeking divinity's fingerprints. Now the evidence had come to me not at the end of a microscope, but in the face of this slender, dying woman, and the touch of her hand across a cafe table. My long, lonely hours, like yours, Amy, seemed not an exile or imprisonment, but a test that I had passed. I was loved. Me, Timothy Fanning of Mercy, Ohio, loved by a woman, loved by a god, a great fatherly god who, measuring my trials, had found me worthy. I had not been made for nothing, and not just loved. I had been charged as heaven's escort. The blue Aegean, where ancient gods and heroes were said to dwell. The whitewashed house one climbed a flight of stairs to reach, the humble bed and homespun furnishings. The workaday sounds of village life and a terrace with a view of olive groves and the wild sea beyond. The soft white light of eternal mornings growing brighter and brighter and brighter still. In my mind's eye, I saw it all. In my arms, she would pass from this life to the next, which surely existed after all, love having come to me, to both of us, at last. Not an hour would have gone by, her body grown cold in my embrace, before I would have followed her from this world. That, too, was part of my design. I would take the last pills, the ones I'd saved for myself, and slip away in silence, so that together
we would be bound eternally to each other and to an invincible universe. My resolve was implacable, my thoughts lucid as ice. I possessed not an iota of doubt. Thus, at the anointed hour of our rendezvous, I took my position at the kiosk, waiting for my angel to appear. In my suitcase, the instruments of our mortal deliverance slept like stones. Little did I know that this was but a foretaste of the wider ruin, that the hurrying travelers flowing around me possessed no inkling that death's prince stood among them. Thrice have I been fathered, thrice betrayed. I will have satisfaction. You, Amy, have dared to love, as once I did. You are hope's deluded champion, as I am sworn to be its enemy. I am the voice, the hand, the pitiless agent of truth, which is the truth of nothing. We were each of us made by a madman. From his design we forked like roads in a dark wood. It has ever been thus, since the materials of life assembled and crawled from nature's muck. Your band approaches. The time grows sweeter by the hour. I know that he is with you, Amy. How could he fail to stand at your side? The man who made you human. Come to me, Amy. Come to me, Peter. Come to me, come to me, come to me.
82. It emerged like a vision, the great city, soaring from the sea like a castle or some vast holy relic, a ruin of staggering dimensions. It boggled the senses, its scope too massive to hold in the mind. The morning sun, low, slanting, blazed off the faces of the towers, ricocheting from the glass like bullets. Peter joined Amy at the bow. She seemed almost preternaturally calm. A profound intensity radiated off her like heat from a stove. Minute by minute, the metropolis loomed higher.
Good God, it's enormous, Peter said.
She nodded, though this was only half the truth. Fanning's presence saturated the city. It was as if a background hum she'd been hearing all her life, so omnipresent as to be barely noticeable, were increasing in volume. She felt a heaviness. That was the only word. A terrible, exhausted heaviness with everything. They had decided to come in from the west. On tepid air they sailed up the Hudson, searching for a place to dock. Daylight was everything. They needed to move quickly. The tide was strong, pushing against them like an invisible hand. Michael. He was working the lines and tiller, seeking to harness any breath of wind. I know. The river was dark as ink. Its force was immense. The day turned toward afternoon. At times, they seemed stopped cold. This is impossible, said Michael. By the time they found a place to tie off, it was 4 o'clock. Clouds had moved in from the south. The air was sultry, smelling of decay. Perhaps 5 hours of daylight remained. From the cabin, Michael retrieved the backpack of explosives, as well as a long spool of cable and the detonator, a wooden box with a plunger. It seemed primitive, but that was the point, he explained. The simple things were always the most reliable, and there would be no second chances to get this right. In the cockpit, they armed themselves and reviewed the plan a final time.
Make no mistake, Alicia said. This island is a death trap. It gets dark. We're done. They disembarked. They were in the West 20s. The roadway was choked with the skeletons of cars. Glassless windows stared at them like the mouths of caves. Here they would diverge, Michael and Lish south to Astor Place, Peter and Amy across Midtown to Grand Central. Michael had fashioned a crude crutch for Alicia from a boat oar. 60 minutes, Peter said. Good luck. They parted cleanly. No goodbyes. Peter and Amy walked north along Fifth Avenue. Block by block, the vertical core of the city rose, fashioning narrow fjords between the buildings. In places, the pavement was buckled with the roots of trees. In others, collapsed into craters that varied in size from a few yards to the width of the street, forcing them to creep along the edge. As they moved up the island, Peter took note of the landmarks. The Empire State, dizzyingly tall, like a single imperious finger pointing to the sky. The Chrysler Building, with its curved crown of burnished metal. The library, sheathed in a feathery cloak of vines, its broad front steps guarded by a pair of pedestaled lions. At the corner of 42nd and 5th, the half-constructed tower Alicia had described came into view. The exposed girders of its upper floors possessed a reddish appearance, the product of decades of slow oxidation. An exterior elevator ascended to the top of the structure. From there, the crane rose another 10 or 15 stories, its horizontal boom parallel to the building's west flank, high above Fifth Avenue. So far, they had seen no trace of Fanning's virals, no scat or animal carcasses, no sounds of movement from the buildings. Except for pigeons, the city seemed dead. Each of them had a semi-automatic rifle and a pistol. Amy also carried the sword. She had offered it to Alicia, but the woman had refused. "Peter's right," Alicia said. "I've got no use for it. Just do me a favor and cut the bastard's head off." They approached from the west, via 43rd to Vanderbilt. Between the buildings, a view of Grand Central emerged. Compared to what was around it, the structure seemed modest in its dimensions, nestled like a heart in the bosom of the city. The streets around it were open to the sun, though an elevated roadway encircled the perimeter at balcony level, creating a zone of darkness beneath. Amy checked her watch. 20 minutes to go. "We need to scout that door," she said. A risk. But Peter agreed. If they moved cautiously and kept low, maintaining an upward line of sight, they would be able to detect any virals beneath the overpass before they got too close. Which was, Peter later realized, precisely what Fanning had intended them to do. To look up. Never mind Alicia's warnings not to underestimate their adversary. Never mind that the street was suspiciously carpeted in vines, or that with each step forward the air thickened with the damp, septic odor of an open sewer. Never mind the faint sound of rustling, which might have been caused by rats, but wasn't. One careless moment was all it took. They crept beneath the overpass, every ounce of their attention focused on the empty ceiling. Peter and Amy never even saw them coming. Michael watched the numbers of the streets decline. A few were impassable, choked with vegetation or debris, others empty, as if forgotten by time. In some of the buildings, trees were growing. Flocks of startled pigeons burst forth in their path, wheeling upward in huge, flapping clouds. At the corner of 18th and Broadway, they paused to rest. Alicia was breathing hard, her face glazed with sweat. "How much farther?" Michael asked. She coughed and cleared her throat. 11 blocks. "I can do this on my own, you know." "Not a chance." The crutch was too unstable. They left it behind and went on, Michael supporting Alicia from one side. A rifle dangled over her shoulder. Her steps were labored, more hobble than walk. From time to time, she issued a tiny gasp he knew she was trying to hide. The minutes stripped away. They came to a small shelter of elaborate iron scrollwork, painted white with pigeon guano. The smell of the sea had grown strong.
This is it, she said. From his pack, Michael removed a lantern and lit the wick. As they descended the stairs, he detected small movements along the floor. He paused and raised the lantern. Rats were scurrying everywhere, long brown ropes of them hugging the edges of the walls. Yuck, he said. They reached the bottom. Arched brick columns supported the roof above the tracks. On the tiled wall, a sign in gold lettering read, Astor Place. Which direction? Michael felt turned around in the dark. This way. South. He dropped onto the rail bed. Alicia handed him her rifle, and he helped her down. As they passed into the tunnel, the air became colder. Water sloshed at their feet. He counted their steps. At 100, the light of his lantern caught a frisson of movement, the hissing spray of water that shot from the edges of the bulkhead. He stepped forward and pressed his hand against the thick metal. Behind it lay untold tons of pressure, the weight of the sea, like an unfired cannon. How much time? Alicia asked. She was leaning against the wall, scanning the tunnel with the rifle. They had used 45 minutes. He stripped off his pack and removed his supplies. Alicia was keeping watch on the far end of the tunnel. He twisted the wires of the blasting caps together, then clipped the end to the cable from the spool. Keeping everything dry would be a challenge. He had to prevent water from contacting the fuses. He returned the dynamite to his pack and searched the door for something to hang it on. Its surface was absolutely smooth. There, Alicia said. Beside the bulkhead, a long rusty screw jutted from the wall. Michael hung his pack on it, handed Alicia the detonator, and began to pull out the cable from the spool. Let's go. They emerged into the Astor Place station and scrambled onto the platform. Unspooling the cable behind them, they headed for the stairs and descended to the first landing. A particle-filled daylight filtered down from street level. Kneeling, Michael placed the plunger on the floor, split the cable with his teeth, and threaded one wire into each of the two slotted screws on top of the box. Alicia was sitting on the step below him, goggles pushed up onto her forehead, her rifle pointed into the blackness below. Circles of sweat drenched her shirt at the throat and armpits. Her jaw was tight with pain. As he tightened the wing nuts, their eyes met. That ought to do it, Michael said. 10 minutes to go. Amy, in darkness. First came the pain, a sharp-edged thudding at the back of her skull. This was followed by the sensation of being dragged. Her thoughts refused to organize. Where was she? What had occurred? What force was pulling her along? Solitary pictures drifted by, pushed by mental winds. A television screen of spitting static. Fat, feathered snowflakes descending from an inky sky. Carter's garden, a carpet of living color. The tossing blue-black sea. There was the floor, dirty, scuffed. Her tongue was dense and heavy in her mouth. She tried to make a sound, but none would come. The floor passed by in aortal jerks, timed to the rhythm of the tugging pressure on her wrists. The idea of resistance took hold, but when she attempted to move her limbs, she found she had no power to act. Her body had been sundered from her will. She sensed, then saw, a light, a kind of filtered glowing, and in the next instant, everything changed. How the air moved on her skin, the way sound behaved, her intuitive sense of the physical parameters around her. Noises expanded and leapt away. The air smelled different, less confined, with a biological tang. Leave her there, please. The voice, nonchalant, even a little bored, came from someplace ahead. The pressure on her wrists released. Her face slammed into the floor. A hot, glowing ball ricocheted around the interior of her skull like an ember spat from a fire. Gently, for God's sake. Consciousness ebbed. Then, like a dark wave returning to shore, broke upon her again. She tasted blood in her mouth. She had bitten her tongue.
The floor was cool against her cheek. The light. What was it? And the sound. A low-grade murmuring, not made by voices per se, but by a volume of breathing bodies. She sensed the presence of faces. Faces, and also hands, lurking in a fog. Her brain told her, "Look harder, Amy. Focus your eyes and look." It wasn't good. It wasn't good at all. She was surrounded by virals. The first layer was crouched around her at a distance of just a yard or two, jaws clicking, throats amphibiously bobbing, hooked fingers caressing the air with small syncopated movements, as if tapping the keys of invisible pianos. This was bad, but not the worst of it. The room writhed and throbbed, a population of hundreds. They carpeted the walls. They gazed down from the balconies like spectators at a contest. They filled each nook and corner and perched atop every ledge. The space was squirming like a pit of snakes. "That all went rather smoothly," the voice drolly continued. "I'm a little bit amazed, actually. I was worried that their enthusiasm might get the better of them. They do that." She was still having difficulty bringing her mind and her body into alignment, to forge the proper chain of command. Everything seemed delayed and out of sync. The voice seemed to emanate from everywhere around her, as if the air were speaking. It flowed over and into her like slick oil, lodging with cloying, buttery sweetness at the back of her throat. "Would it be too obvious to say how long I've waited to meet you? But I have. Since the day Jonas told me of your existence, I've wondered, when will we meet? When will my Amy come to me?" My Amy. Why was the voice calling her that? She discovered the sky. No, not the sky. The ceiling far above, and on it the image of the stars with gilded figures floating among them. "Oh, you should have heard the man. How guilty he felt. How sorry he was. Jesus, Tim, you should see her. She's just a little kid. She doesn't even have a proper last name. She's just some girl from nowhere." The backward stars, thought Amy, as if the heavens were being viewed from without, or were reflected in a mirror. She felt her thoughts attaching to this notion, and as they did, new ideas began to form. As if stumbling from a dream, her mind began to open to her circumstances. Memories were rising to the surface. An image entered her mind. Peter, his body airborne, crashing through a plate glass window. A dark chuckle. "Not really funny, I suppose, when you put it in the context of a few billion corpses. Still, the whole thing was quite a performance. Jonas missed his true calling. He should have been an actor." Fanning, she thought. The voice was Fanning. And everything came slamming back. "I waited so long, Amy." A heavy sigh. "Always hoping that my Liz would be on the next train. Do you know what that's like? But how could you? How could anyone?" She struggled onto all fours. She was in the west end of the hall. To her right, the ticket windows, barred like cells in a jail. To her left, the shadowy recesses of train platforms. Shrouded windows, both behind her and to her right, pulsed with a febrile glow. Ahead, at a distance of perhaps 100 feet, stood the kiosk, topped by its pearlescent clocks. A man was standing there, an altogether unremarkable-looking man wearing a dark suit. He was positioned in profile, back erect and chin tipped slightly upward, left hand tucked casually in the pocket of his suit coat, his attention aimed at the dark maws of the tunnels.
How alone she must have felt at the end. How afraid. No words of comfort. Not the touch of a hand for company.
Still he did not look at her. All around her the virals trilled and stroked, flexed and snapped. She had the sense that they were kept at bay only by the thinnest of invisible barriers.
I have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. That's T.S. Eliot, in case you were wondering. An oldie, but a goodie. When it came to existential exhaustion, the man was one smart cookie.
Where was Peter? Had the virals killed him? What of Michael and Alicia? She thought, water. She thought, time. How much had passed?
But the answer to this question was like an empty drawer in her brain. Moving just her eyes, she scanned for something to use as a weapon. But there was nothing. Only the virals and the inverted heavens, and her heart beating in her throat.
Oh, I had my books, my thoughts. I had my memories. But those things only take a man so far.
Fanning paused, then said, with more directness,
Consider this place, Amy. Imagine it as it once was. Everyone hurrying, rushing here, rushing there. The appointments, the assignations, the dinners with friends. How gloriously alive it was. All our lives, the one thing we never seem to have enough of is time. Time to work, time to eat. Time to sleep. Time to love and be loved before it's time to die.
He shrugged. But I digress. You came to kill me, wasn't it?
He turned to face her. His right hand, now revealed, held the sword.
Just to clear the decks, let me say that I don't hold it against you in the least. Au contraire, mon ami. That's French, by the way. Liz always said it was the mark of a truly cultured person. I never had much of a knack for languages, but with a century to kill, you get around to trying new things. Any preference? Italian, Russian, German, Dutch, Greek? How about Latin? We could do this whole thing in Norwegian, if you'd like.
Close your mouth, Amy's brain commanded her. Use the silence, because it's all you have.
Fanning's face soured.
Well, your choice. I was only trying to make a little small talk.
He gave a backhanded wave.
Let's have a look at you.
More hands upon her. A large, smooth male and a slightly smaller female, with a wispy diadem of white hair on her otherwise featureless skull. They seized her by the upper arms and whisked her forward, her feet skimming the tile, and dumped her unceremoniously to the floor.
I said gently, for fuck's sake.
Looming like a thundercloud, Fanning stood above her, his aura of merry confidence replaced by jaw-clenched rage.
You.
He pointed the sword at the large male.
Get over here.
A spark of hesitation in the creature's eyes. Or did she imagine this? The viral scuttled forward. It dropped to its knees at Fanning's feet and bowed its head submissively, like a subdued dog. Fanning raised his voice to the room.
Everyone, are you listening? Are you hearing my words, God damn it? This woman is our guest. She is not a piece of luggage for you to toss around as you please.
I expect you to treat her with respect.
As he raised the sword, Amy covered her head.